is one of the most successful professional triathlon coaches of the last years. He has a large endurance experience since 1989 as an athlete and coach. He has been head national Canadian coach during the 2008 Olympic Games, head coach of the British Federation, and he's currently working as Olympic Performance Director for the Italian Triathlon Federation. But also, Joel is known by his independent triathlon squad, the JFT crew, which include most of the top 10 men and women U2 elite triathletes. In this first part, we talk with Joel about how he understands and designs the training, how he uses training data, as well as how important is the self-management of the athletes.
Hello, Joel. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me, guys.
It's a pleasure to talk with you. First of all, we want to start talking about your philosophy of training, because you describe your philosophy of training as find the minimal effective dose an athlete can do to achieve the desired outcome. How this philosophy come to you?
Yeah, I don't know if that would be the all-encompassing philosophy, but it's certainly one of the models that I think about. And I guess it comes from the desire to find consistency through performance. And over time, you know, the factors that impact consistency, typically the training load can create problems with health or biomechanical injury. And so, you know, I've thought a lot about what is the training stimulus that gets the athletes to improve, that gets the response we want, what's the right amount of stress. And we know in endurance sport, the athletes are capable of some amazing things, you know, from a training performance or competition performance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that doesn't mean we need to do those amazing things in training all the time, you know. And in fact, you know, the biggest mistakes that I've made in my coaching and witnessed athletes make is when we overdo it and we do too much. And then it impacts what we can do either the following days or we create the start or an acute problem, you know, again, with health or injury. So I've thought, well, what is the right amount of training stress? Like every coach, I think, you know, it's part and parcel of what we're doing is manipulating training stress. And then this concept, I don't know where I heard it. It's not original thought from me, but I've adopted it as a concept that can be used to say, well, what's the right training stress for the individual? And whenever I hear, okay, minimum, it doesn't sound, well, we're trying for maximum performance. How can you have the minimum of something? But I think it's more a concept of what's the right level of stress, what's the right level of work, and at what point is going beyond that not giving us more incremental gains from that training session. You know, any person, they can accumulate a certain amount of work. And we kind of know this is built up historically over time. You know, what's the right amount of, you know, threshold work or speed work? We end up having created some ranges. And again, the thought is going past those ranges doesn't give us more benefit versus the higher risk of problems. And it connects to my general model of when I think of training is we should never do today so much that it impacts our ability to do what we plan to do tomorrow. So if we plan our training program for the week or the month, if we overshoot what the athletes can recover from, and then we have to change our program for the subsequent days, then I think that's a training error. That's an error on our side in terms of programming. So, you know, coming back to, well, let's get the dose right so that we can do what we plan to do. I mean, that doesn't mean that the plan that we had on paper, as it were, was correct. But if we plan out what we think the athletes can do, and then we exceed that acute dose on any given day of work, then we know that they'll be more fatigued. We'll see problems crop up. So it kind of comes from that desire to find consistency and to find what training stress the athlete can recover from and that gets them stronger as opposed to, you know, weakening them because it's too much, you know, so it's one of the models that drives me. It's not it's a moving target, if you like, because it's not a fixed amount and it changes on any given day, you know. I don't set out to think of what's the minimum, but more what's the optimal dose. And I think I've benefited from having worked with a lot of different athletes that I'm perhaps more confident doing a bit less than I used to be, and that some others are, because we've got the, you know, the great feedback of the athletes I'm fortunate to work with, that we run these experiments all the time. You know, how much training do we do and what result do we get? And therefore we can adapt that. And typically the minimal effective dose of training load in a general way has actually gone down over time. We do less. And particularly we're talking about intensity training. In this concept, it does apply to general volume or total workload. But in particular, I think it resonates with high intensity training. What's the dose of, you know, quote unquote speed work or threshold work or tempo or whatever type of intensity you want to use? What's the right amount of that? I think that's where the opportunity for error is so much bigger, due to either the biomechanical stress or the general stress of a single acute training session. Whereas for, you know, easy training or low intensity training, there it's more difficult to exceed that by, you know, and have negative impacts. I mean, certainly for some athletes, you know, if you're new to running at a high level, of course, if you increase even your easy training frequency too much, you can have problems. But again, it's that concept: what's the right optimal dose of intensity for each athlete? And that's where I've kind of honed in on as a really important factor.
That's a very interesting approach. And this approach model, as you say, in your training, is something that you based on science, or is simply because it's something that you have known or have discovered with your experience?
You might say that, I mean, all coaches got to work in a type of scientific process, if you like. We have a theory, we test the theory, we see what the results are. That's an interesting question when I think of, well, what are the ranges that we work with? Where do they come from? You know, in part experience, you know, how much threshold training is the right dose? You know, I don't know if this has, you know, been studied as, you know, it's an interesting point. I don't know the answer to that. You know, my thought is, well, I've built this up over time based on what I saw people doing before me, what other coaches have done, books I've read, you know, what's the right amount, and then seeing what are the results. You know, if you try to do more than a certain amount of high intensity training, if you try to do, you know, more than, I don't know, we'll ballpark it and say, you know, 60 minutes of threshold training, or, you know, functional threshold, however you want to think about that intensity. If you try to do more than that, then that might be too much, you know, so let's do less than that. You know, so I suppose it's not coming from a formal, you know, an academic or research point of view, but it's built up over time based on the work of others. And, you know, in terms of, yeah, that would be an interesting point to think about, is where do those come from? But in any case, we can see the outcomes. You know, when we have a general range that we work with. You know, when I'm, you know, my model of training, we don't do a lot of threshold training, but let's say anyway, if we did in the short time that we do threshold, mean, you know, I always tend to simplify things in my mind. So let's say race pace training, right? Let's talk about running and race pace training. We run 5 and 10K typically, the group that I'm working with. So we don't actually almost ever do, for example, 10Ks of race pace training in a single session. You know, if we accumulate, so we don't do the 10 by 1K at 10K pace, for example. For me, that's a stress that's too high in the context of what we're trying to do, for example. So I've developed my own ranges. And then within that, the individual approach is, well, those, there's going to be a range that athletes can withstand, that they can absorb, they can recover from. And that's not the same for everyone. So, you know, on a given training session, we will have some athletes, and I talk about running a lot because running is the one where the errors have the most consequence, such as biomechanical injury, you know, physical injury is the risk. So we'll have a range, and if we're on the track on a given day, for example, we'll have, even though the majority of the athletes are probably doing the same type of session, not always, but let's say for the purpose of this, they are, we'll have a range. You know, some athletes might do, let's say 5Ks of work, and some might do 7. So there's a range there, and it's based on what I know about the athlete's history, what I know about their recent experience, what do we know about the current training state that they're in, and observing the workout, watching how they're managing it, what effort it's taking to do it. So we have to take all those factors into account in order to determine the right stress on that given day.
As you say, you give a lot of importance of the context, I suppose, because the context of triathlon is different from the context of swimming itself, cycling itself, and running itself. And how you combine all these disciplines into triathlon, giving importance to the context?
I think that's the interesting thing about triathlon is you cannot separate the three sports in a training model. Interestingly, that's how we started in triathlon. In before there was such thing as a triathlon coach. You know, if you were doing triathlon, you might swim with a swimming group and a swimming coach. You might run with a running group and cycling, etc. And that persisted a long time until you know, the specialization of triathlon coaching emerged, and you know, brings us to today. And it's been a really interesting area for me to investigate over the years of the influence of the disciplines on other disciplines from a training point of view. And I mean, often it can come down to it, you know, you can probably think of it in a fatigue model that it, you know, if an athlete, depending what you want to do, using it, some examples that if you want to improve your swimming and your general training load is high, you'll probably find that it's difficult to improve skills. It's difficult to learn skills or to be really focused on your biomechanics, your technique. And in particular, if you're doing a lot of running at the same time, that has an impact typically on the swimming performance. We see it suppressed in general, and attribute that to, you know, energy. How much energy do you have for doing a more technically oriented sport? If you're more fatigued because you're doing a lot of high training load, you might find it difficult to improve your swimming. In the short term, we know that, so we don't worry too much about it, that the swimming performance is suppressed a little bit, meaning that the times, the training intensity that we see, it's not training intensity exactly, but we'll say the outcomes, the times of, you know, intervals and such will be slower under heavy fatigue. And then when they freshen up, they taper, they find suddenly they're faster again. So that's normal. But if we have somebody that needs to improve their technique, they need to improve their ability to focus on their mechanics, we might have to manipulate the training load in the other sports in order to free up energy in order to do that. And we also have to think about the timing in the day and the timing in the week. There are some athletes that neuromuscularly, they don't function as well in the early mornings. So it's hard to improve skills and be focused on technical training early in the mornings. And there are others, well, if you do that same session in the afternoon, they might be pre-fatigued too much from what we did on the bike and run. So, you know, it illustrates, on one hand, the complexity of the different sports and the integration of them. But it's what we have to take into account is what is the impact of overall fatigue and fitting three sports in across a period of time, and all the things that you want to train across all the areas. You know, how do we then dig in and isolate some of those? What factors might we have to manipulate in order to do that? And what is the interaction between them? You know, similarly, for running, I think, some athletes don't have a running background. If they want to focus and feel good on their running, they want to feel with energy, but maybe they're cycling and swimming a lot. You might have to also manipulate that training load. You know, at the same time, I used to, in the past, I did these focus phases where we would do a lot of one discipline at the same time. Let's say to improve the swimming, we would do like a winter swimming focus, and we'll do, you know, months of high volume swimming and probably lower volume bike and run. And over time, I've moved away from that because I think ultimately, you, in order to really improve as an athlete, as a triathlete, and also really be able to pull the training process together, you have to be able to move towards developing all three disciplines, not exactly at the same time, but in a sequence in order to prepare to competition. And we know sort of anecdotally that the top athletes, the best athletes, are able to maintain that balance between the three sports and recover from overall training load the best. So, you know, again, that coming back to that interaction between the three sports, there are ways to, of course, we can measure training load. But it's imperfect at the moment. More recently, you know, some of the devices, like, you know, a Garmin watch, for example, you can set it to the swimming pool and it will give you some kind of score, you know. And various platforms have tried to sort of line them up, if you like, between the three sports. And now we have, you know, even again, you know, these sport watches that tried to be able to do everything. You know, we used to have, you know, accelerometers and things on shoes, and now they're just in the watch, for example. And we get some kind of score or data from this. But as far as pulling all of them together and having like a global metric, we're probably not quite there yet in terms of the, you know, it's easy to make the device. It's easy to make an accelerometer now. It's easy to generate data. Whether that's valid or not, and what to do with it, and how do you integrate across all three? So I'd say it's a bit blunt at the moment. So you can have a certainly global workload across all three sports, and I'm not sure we really know, you know, what it means. You know, what are these numbers really valid across the sports? And what would we do with them? So my view is we're not there yet in terms of quantification exactly between the sports. So I'm not looking at it from that perspective. I'm looking at it, what are we trying to achieve in our training? How might we manipulate the training loads between the sports in order to both in a global way that the athlete improves and progresses and is consistent over time, and also based on what we're trying to, as I say, improve in one area or change in one area. So, you know, it's an emerging in the last 5-10 years, but emerging concept is how do you manage that? What are the best practices and for the individual? So I'm not sure how much that is quantified. I'm perhaps not the best person to ask about that. I leave that area to academics, researchers, sports scientists, or other coaches who perhaps have more bandwidth to dig into it. And I'll be happy to read what they write and learn from that and maybe implement something like that in the future.
In this model that you explained, do you co-design the training process with the athletes, or do they just follow your list of recipes?
More the latter. I designed it over years and, you know, iterations as you would. And so I have a model, you know, of the way that I work and the way that I think. And so when an athlete comes to me, they're signing up to participate in that model, if you like. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some major principles like the one we talked about at the beginning, the minimal effective dose or the general model of, you know, aerobic load over time and the way that we periodize training, all of these things. So there are some individual differences, but I'd say by and large, they follow the same model, you know, within, you know, if I were to pull a number out of the air, you know, 95% of it is going to be the same, you know, maybe 90% is the same. And the rest is subtleties of the workload within the same model. So, and that's not static, that's changed, and evolved. When I reflect, you know, 15 years ago, that if I was to look at a training program that I did now, and then 10 years ago and five, it will have evolved a lot in the 15 years and less in the 5 years. But of course, the subtleties are all the difference. And some of that is because we've had an evolution in draft legal triathlon. The way that the races are a little bit different. For example, the bike courses, the courses that the athletes compete on the bike are more technical, and therefore the actual physical demands are different. More technical means a lot more corners, more short sprints during the ride, more skills required, and therefore that's had an impact on training. To some degree, but not a lot, you know, which are the dominant athletes can drive a little bit of that. Some years ago in women's triathlon, and probably now as well, there's a number of very fast swimmers and swim bikers, if you like, mm-hmm. who also can run fast enough to win the race. So if you're not in the front group, then you really have a much lower chance of being on the podium. And therefore, a lot of athletes, of course, see that and they spend more time working on their swimming than they might otherwise if, you know, around the Beijing Olympics time, it wasn't so swim focused, but it was really about running fast. And there was always big, big groups coming off the bike and it was a fast run. And not to say that the run isn't fast now, but that kind of example of how the demands have changed a little bit. Probably that we have seen the runs, both men and women, slow down a little bit in the last years when due to the demands of the bike going up, which is kind of what you would expect. But, you know, so we've again had to manage training in that way. Subtly, though, it's subtly. So we kind of come back to this model, you know, in my work as a private coach, which I differentiate between working for the Italian Federation because it is quite different rule. Mm-hmm. Now athletes are deciding that they want to work with me. So, and of course they have to educate themselves on what that means, you know, other than, oh, this fellow has coached some other fast athletes, so I want to sign up. You want them to understand a little bit about the, how you do things, your philosophy and such. And, ultimately, though, they have to learn on the ground and, you know, what it means. You know, I guess the answer to the question, there's a general model that athletes are really signing up to that. And we have to find the right way to modify that to suit the individual within that context. But the bulk of what we're doing is still the same model.
And from your experience, Do you pay attention to the self-knowledge and the self-awareness of your athletes during the training process?
Very much so. I think one of the key principles of the way that I work is the development of the ability for the athletes to self-manage and make decisions themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that I coach is designed to encourage that kind of learning. You know, there's the expression, you know, the athletes can feel but can't see, and the coach can see and can't feel. And, you know, ultimately, the athlete, though, has to make the decision about, you know, what's enough. Sometimes we can see that, and sometimes we can see when their exertion is too high, we can see that, and we might stop a session. We can see based on their body language, their behavior. We might, you know, because the critical moments, again, you know, for me are always coming back to when we've done enough and when we're now working in a zone of higher risk, a zone of workload. And those are the key moments in coaching, you know, if, where you make mistakes, then it can have bad consequences for later. So we want to avoid those. And the key moments are making good decisions in those moments. And typically a good decision is that you decide to stop early, or you stop when you've done enough, or you're disciplined about your intensity and you're disciplined about your pace, meaning you don't exceed the desired pace or the desired intensity. Because again, the marginal benefits for doing more, whereas also the risks are perhaps not marginal, but significant. So I want the athletes to own that process themselves, because I'm not going to be there all the time. I know our model is training together and, you know, coaching with observation, but they have to be able to make those decisions on their own, and also within the training session based on what they feel, you know. And you know, it's a learning process. There's no finish point with that one either, but they, you know, we want them to determine kind of when they've done enough and to be confident about that. I mean, because a lot of the training for endurance athletes is related to their confidence. You know, they do some special training and they feel more confident. They feel that now they are ready to perform at a higher level. And of course, the unintended consequences of pursuing confidence via training stress is the risk of overdoing it and then having problems that persist for weeks or months. You know, it's the thing, of course, you don't see at the moment, but you know, it only takes one run, and when you're on the limit of stress, and now you've got a bone injury that persists for 12 weeks. You know, it can be. It's not usually from one run. It's usually from riding the stress limit for too long, too much in the red, if you like, of stress, and there we are. Now we've lost 3 months, you know, or something. So the consequences for that are significant. And I mean, that's an extreme example, but the equally, you know, if an athlete exceeds, especially in triathlon, a training stress for on a given day, maybe they can't complete the following day's swim or bike or, you know, or the training program that we intended to follow. And now there's a knock-on effect of where now we've missed multiple sessions that we hoped to do at a certain kind of quality of work. And now we're on the back foot, you know, for days, because we got a bit too excited in one session, you know, and we pushed a bit too hard, or we didn't, you know, I mean, probably the most common situation as an athlete is a bit fatigued going into a session. Again, as they are, as endurance athletes, always fatigue. But what level of fatigue? And maybe the session, they just have to reach a bit too much, have to push a bit too hard. Their RPE is too high, and probably we should do a bit less then. Now the optimal training load on that day is less. Or, you know, there's certainly plenty of cases where we'll not do the session. We'll do the warm up, do some strides. You can see it's not quite right. We have a discussion. Let's not do the session. Just run easy or bike easy instead. Those kind of decisions, the athlete has to take a big part of ownership of that, because, you know, they have to balance this drive, this motivation. They want to be better. They want to win races. They, you know, they need to improve. But as we said, you know, we need to get it right. And so we try to have an environment that encourages that kind of decision, that it's not a failure if you can't do the session as we designed. In fact, I would try to say, you know, it's hard to make a situation like that a really positive experience. But I don't want them to feel bad about that kind of decision, and which is very tempting. And a lot of them have the culture of where they've come from, and then perhaps in the past, is, well, you just push through, you just keep going, you work hard, you know, you have to work harder than everybody, you have to do more than everyone, you know, this kind of mentality that's right. Pervasive in endurance sport. And so we, you know, usually if the athlete can't do a session, it's a programming error, meaning that I've not been able to anticipate or other factors have come into play that now they can't do what we plan to do. And so we got to make a decision about that. And again, usually the decision is that you modify it somehow down. Yeah. And that's where the athlete needs to be playing their part in that. And they're all different, you know, some of them, will be more stubborn and they want to push through and sometimes if they are not taking the bait, as it were, at the beginning, if you say, what do you think about like doing a bit less today? No, I'm good. You know, maybe then it gets pushed on a little bit, but then we see, okay, what happened after? What was the session really like? Sometimes they'll do the session and it will be fine. But we won't know until some days later if it was the right decision. And other times, you know, in the moment, okay, now after two intervals or whatever, then now we've pulled the pin on the session, now we've stopped. So there is a high degree of ownership on that. And again, it's knowing also from my side, well, what do we know about these athletes? Where do you need to be more firm about, well, this particular one's had all kinds of injuries over the last years. And we know that, you know, even though they're motivated in this particular moment, that it's not worth the risk. And we're just going to say, look, no session today because these reasons. And so that's where you have to be more directive then. You have to be more, stronger in that particular moment. So, you know, but the concept in general, you know, coming back to that, is that the athletes have to take ownership of what they're doing. And indeed, in the context that I'm working in, this private context, is actually quite different than Olympic sport in general, or where they might have come from, where we have a high federation involvement. We have a high, you know, most federations provide a lot of programming, provide resources across the spectrum from money to expertise, you know, and that's the job of most, you know, Olympic federations. So that system exists and many have developed in that system, and that's what they know. But that system doesn't accommodate for everyone. And what we've seen increasingly is, you know, there's different reasons why we ended up in this place. And it's not, I think triathlon is probably relatively unique amongst Olympic sports in this way, where we have a lot of the top athletes of different countries training outside this primary structure of their federations. There's a lot of reasons why that is. I think that's probably a whole discussion to think about that. But for the purposes of right now, you know, these athletes have decided themselves, typically, that they would like to do something different. And that they were prepared to take that decision is a really positive step. From my view, you can see the difference in the athletes where they're part of a system and maybe they don't even believe what they're doing is right. Maybe they're not really that bought into what their training is, their environment, but they do it anyway. You know, because it's free, if you like, for them, or it's included, or it's just, you know, there's a strong force within the Olympic movement about, well, you know, if you're an athlete, this is your federation, they tell you what to do, you do it, you know. Whether or not you believe in that is another thing. And so when an athlete decides they're going to step out of that, usually for me it means, and it signals, that they're prepared to take a greater ownership of their career, greater ownership of their training. They're prepared to invest in themselves. And those are all really positive signals, you know, that, you know, once they arrive and we have discussions with somebody like myself, they've already taken a really important step to own their own process as a professional, and as somebody that is internally motivated to achieve the best performances. So, you know, it's sort of baked in from the beginning of when they arrive at me, they have already got to a certain point of that. And that's most of the athletes that I work with. They, you know, though, you know, we can have discussions, you know, how do they end up with me? Most of them, by now, they either know about me already and they reach out directly, or they talk to one of the other athletes. But it's still, for many of them, scary to take that step away from the federation. It's you know, it's going against the grain a little bit. Most federations, you know, and I can say this from the Italian side, you know, because we try to do all the same things. We try to provide as many programs and quality for the athletes as part of our system. But we know we can't accommodate everyone, so we have to find ways to adapt in that way. But you know, from an inside federation point of view, that you can use your resources more effectively when the athletes you work with directly. So, you know, we walk, you know, it's an interesting balance, you know, and when an athlete goes outside of the program, then some of the resources that you might have will be less, they're not able to implement them as easily. And sports science is one of the most common ones that happens is, you know, maybe we have a physiologist that works, we'll say, for the Italian Federation. We don't at the moment, but let's say we do, or other federations, they may have a physiologist. But if an athlete is outside the main federation program, meaning they're working with a private or independent coach that's not part of the federation system, it's very difficult to implement any kind of principle, anything that you want to, it's very difficult to implement because you're not connected daily or, you know, in a meaningful way to those coaches. So, you know, the athletes know this and the federations know this. So mostly I wouldn't say it's encouraged the athletes should leave their programs. It's more the athletes driving that. And we find this kind of interesting balance between, you know, working with federations, you know, the athletes deciding, you know, what they're going to do. And ultimately the performance is what will enable it to continue or not. But, you know, where we started this particular question, thinking about the autonomy, the self-management, you know, so as I say, all, you know, it's a fundamental principle of what we do in multiple layers. There's the training side that we talked about. And also there's actually this decision to do this, this decision to take an independent path is also part of that, because it does also mean that those athletes have to manage more elements of their career than they might have had they stayed in the federation system. Or you know, it's not that they leave entirely, you know, the federation system, but they are certainly are more independent and required to do more for themselves. So when we have a training camp, while my organization does a lot, they still have to do things that maybe the federation would have done for them if it was a centrally organized camp. So it all comes back to this, like, how much self-management, how much autonomy, how much decisions do you take over your own career? And that being a very positive indicator of performance. And I think it's one of the factors why groups like mine have been able to find success. I think that's my theory, is that because in order to even decide to join, you had to be in the right mental space. You have to be able to take control of things yourself. And it's a really positive point. And so again, it sort of self-selects because of that, but I do think it's a really positive point about how do you improve as an athlete, taking ownership of what you're doing. And of course, younger athletes may be less ready to do that than some older, more mature athletes. And then we run into the catch 22, as it were, is, if you don't do the right things when you're young, you maybe don't develop as far. So there's a bit of, a leap of faith required, or courage, or find a way to make it happen, you know, when you're young. Because if you wait too long, you won't have the resources to be able to do it, or you won't be able to take that step. But when you're young, it's more complicated.
Yeah.
But still positive.
This episode comes to the end. You can find more episodes following our program, Linking Theory and Practice. Thank you for listening to our podcast.